Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, academic classroom lectures in business and economics recorded for podcast. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4 for Spring Semester 2010. Lecture 6, delivered on January 28, 2010. The title of this lecture is Review of Accounting Essentials.
Today, Review of Accounting Essentials. I again emphasize, finance is not accounting. And there is an unfortunate myth that an accountant does financial analysis. In fact, over the years, I have lamented in classes, wanted ads for corporate positions, financial analyst needed, lists all the things that a financial analyst does, and then says accounting degree required. To which I respond in my best academic tone, bite me. No, accounting is not finance. We use accounting data to the extent that we must, because that's where the numbers are. Oftentimes, but accounting is not finance. We can, however, convert accounting numbers to financially usable numbers, and there are some standard ways to do that. But I have to go through accounting in very basic terms. And those of you, I assume that you've all seen accounting, and you will say, well, this is awfully easy what you're doing. This is oversimplifying it. Well, yes, it is. The essentials that we need for finance are what I cover here. However, now that I have given a negative tone to accounting, let me try to redeem myself. Accounting is as old as human civilization. In fact, it is very likely the case that the first writing was nothing but accounting for animals. And it got complicated as more animals were kept by wealthy nobles in ancient prehistoric times. And then that system of taking note of the numbers of animals, the amount of crops, the amount of land, expanded into a full-blown writing system. We are certain that that is what was the case with cuneiform, one of the earliest languages that was written. In the Middle Ages, accounting came into its own in its fairly modern form. The double-entry accounting system was actually developed by a monk, which is sort of troubling as it might be. His name was Niccolo Pacioli, and he developed the modern double-entry accounting system. And that was a major development in capitalist markets, because once numbers could be put down and there was an assurance of the financial integrity through an objective accounting system, then capital flows could be more certain, risk was reduced, and that made businesses take off. Inventors, corporations, early entrepreneurs, and all of that in the Renaissance relied heavily upon the accountants to provide investors, suppliers, and buyers with assurance. So I don't want to dismiss accounting at all. The emphasis that we have in finance is not on net income that you see in accounting. And the reason is because net income includes a lot of things that are not actually cash money expenses. Also, net income that you see on an income statement of a firm does not include opportunity costs. all of those hidden costs that don't represent cash, but are there anyway, affecting the decisions of the firms. Now, there are certainly ways that accountants are trying to reflect and to signal and to note opportunity costs and hidden costs, but they cannot do it entirely simply because they are bound by rules to have some proof of what they are saying, a documentation that this really was an expense or this is something that has been incurred. Now, let me go through, first of all, the fundamental equation of accounting. The total assets of a firm equal the liabilities plus the owner's equity. Now, and the order in which the right side is written is relevant. And that's simply because liabilities must be satisfied first. What remains, that residual, if there is any, is the owner's equity. In a way, total assets minus liabilities is the owner's equity, if there is any at all. In a corporation, the separation, there is a wall of separation. These liabilities are the corporation's, not the owner's. Unless it is a corporation, those liabilities can and do spill to the owners, and that requires them to indemnify themselves extraordinarily compared to what they would have to in a corporation. Look, if you buy stock in a firm, the firm can go belly up. It can have millions and millions of dollars in debts it can't pay. What do you lose? Your investment, pure and simple. You are not responsible for the losses of the firm. You'll lose your shirt, sure, but they won't come through, the debt holders won't come through and get you. This is a simplistic way of putting it, though, because liabilities are continuing on most corporations. There are liabilities that come due now, liabilities that come due in a week, liabilities that come due in 20, 30 years. So it's not a matter of, well, at any given time, all the liabilities are covered by the total assets. No. The issue is one of timeliness, of ability to pay the liabilities, ability to satisfy what liabilities are coming due. As long as there is that ability to satisfy liabilities that are coming due, then the corporation is solvent. Enough of that. And in finance, as I said, net income is really not that important. What matters is cash flow. That's what we care about, cash flow. You could very well have $1 million. But if you can't get any money out of the ATM machine, you will starve to death. You will be dead. You'll be rich, but you'll be dead. That's just the reality of it. And unfortunately, we can't live off what the accountant says. Well, you made a huge income last year, but you are still a P-O-P-O. You don't have any money. If you are a corporation, you could have billions of dollars in assets. But if you can't pay the bills that are coming due now, your debt holders are going to go and take you to court and say, we want your assets. We want them. If you can't pay them in a timely fashion, they'll just cut right through and take you to court for them. You might very well have a lot of stuff, but if you can't pay your bills, you are insolvent. So in finance, everything is about cash flow. Can we keep the cash flow positive? And that means that we have to use the accounting statements and tease them back to get what we care about, which is that cash flow. Now, there are financial statements, and I know I'm doing a lot of review here, but hear me, because there's a few little twists that I want to put on this that come both from the fact that I am a financial analyst and a financial economist, and from my real-world experience as a business consultant. I helped corporations come into being, and I kept them alive, and I kept them compliant with relevant securities law. So hear me well when I talk about what I'm going to say here. The first of the financial statements of a firm is the P&L, the income statement. This represents the flows of documentable funds through a period of time, be it a week, a month, a quarter, or a year, or possibly even a longer period. Now, for the purposes of this, I'll just say, well, we're going to talk about annual financial statements. Now, the income statement is relatively straightforward, as I'm going to do it. I'm not going to get fancy in a finance course. We are not into accounting nuance, usually. We're going to say, all right, you've got your revenues. Now, right there is a problem for a finance person. Yes, you've got your revenues. You sold $100,000 worth of merchandise last year. You're really doing good, aren't you, Sparky? Well, you sold $95,000 of that on credit. Oops. Yeah. Sweet. So you got enough money for Denny's, and that's it. See, so in that case, I can say net income is, my revenues were $100,000, but really? Because my receivables shot up $95,000, there goes my cash flow down. I have to cut that down by $95,000 because the receivables rising reduces how much is true money into my pocket. So rising receivables would be a ding to my sources and uses. Revenues. Now, we're going to take away, in a manufacturing operation, cost of goods sold. Now, this would not be there if it's a service company. Cost of goods sold represents the cost of those items you sold that can be traced directly to the items themselves. So, you are now an executive at State Barn. You make $200,000 a year. Yes, you can finally get friends on Facebook. But that's wonderful. But you see, that's really not your salary when State Barn talks about its expenses. You can't associate that with some product. Well, we made this insurance product and we sold it for $500,000, and he was $200,000 of that expense. We can't do that. So that would not be a cost of goods sold. If, however, you made a toy for $5, and you can say, well, I bought this for a dollar, this for 50 cents, and this for 75 cents. I can do that. Get off me, okay? $2.25. I can put that directly against the $5 that I sold the toy for. So in that case, the cost of goods sold, I can reflect the cost of goods sold. So you see, more likely in a manufacturing or a production type of environment where there's a physical thing, I would see a cost of goods sold number where I could associate costs directly with what was sold. And it's what was sold, not what was produced, because what was produced will include what was sold plus build up an inventory. So all I can do is use the costs of things that went into revenues that actually created revenues, not that built up my inventories. And then we come, that creates gross profit or gross income. That line right there does. Now we come to the biggie that is not a real expense. It is depreciation. Once I've gotten to gross income, I start knocking off things that can't be associated directly with the production of a given good that I sold. The first of those is depreciation. But here's the problem. Depreciation, in the accounting sense, does not exist. You will never, no matter what business you are in, I promise you, you will never write out a check pay to the order of depreciation. You will never do it. And therefore, that line right there on a financial statement, we in finance are going to have to add that back in if we want anything even remotely resembling a cash flow representation. Depreciation doesn't exist. It just doesn't. We have to have a system for recognizing the cost of big things that we buy for our business. We have to have a system for it. We are surely not going to buy a building for $50 million and take just $50 million off our current financial statement, our current income statement. We need a way to spread that across time to represent a more, in some way, its use over a period of time. So in many big ticket items, we have a system by which we will divide a cost over a period of time that would reasonably represent the usable life of the good. Now, unfortunately, I'm sure some of you at least remember the dark, dark days of accounting. There are different ways to calculate depreciation. The happiest way is straight line depreciation. We take something, say 10 years, we divide the cost of it by 10, and we just take that amount out every year. Joy, that's easy. Then you have these other systems like MACRS, Modified Accelerated Cost Recovery System. You have the sum of years digit method. Do they still teach sum of years digits anymore in accounting? You're kind of looking at me blankly about sum of years digits. That was one of the old ways that it was done. See, the trick here is that we're not allowed to just expense the whole amount of a big ticket item right away, usually. So we have to have a way to divide it up. Now, accounting standards allow us to load that division towards the front. So if I do straight line, 10 years on $20 million, that'd be $2 million a year. It'd be very cool if we could load more than $2 million each year in the first years and less in the out years. That way we would be able to reduce our tax exposure. And that's what these accelerated systems do. They load the depreciation expense into the early years and leave the tail of lower expensing out for the later years. Now, interestingly enough, there are just all kinds of classes of goods, and the rules for how many years you divide it up into can get to be almost Byzantine. And then there are also a lot of exceptions where you can take some items that are actually fairly big ticket and expense them in a single year, which is very cool. And I've used that trick in businesses of my own. Things that I thought, well, geez, I'm going to have to spread this out over a 3 or a 5 year depreciation period, and I found out that it qualified just to be knocked off all in 1 year. So there are, you have to know the system pretty well to know how to use it to your best advantage. But anyway, depreciation does not exist per se. However, make no mistake about it, depreciation is a real thing in an economic sense. There is something very real called economic depreciation. The asset becomes less valuable as time goes on, as you wear it down, as you use it. Buildings, computers, and all of those things lose value. So accounting in a depreciation, in a sense, is a proxy for economic depreciation. Not a perfect proxy, but then again, the economic version of it would be subject to an awful lot of speculation. Well, how long does this thing take to wear out? 2 years, 5 years, 10 years? It's hard to say. So accounting gives us a mechanistic way of dealing with it. Now, after you've knocked out the depreciation, then you knock out your selling and administrative expenses, S&As. Your selling and administrative expenses. Your salaries, your utilities, your meals and entertainment. All of those things we just sort of lump into selling and administrative expenses. I want to bring this thing down. I want to get this thing to go down, and I can't. Well, let me right over here where you can see it a little better. But, okay. Now, once you have taken out the revenues, less cost of goods sold, you get your gross, and then you take out your depreciation, and then you take out your selling and administrative expenses, you get down to what we call the EBIT, the earnings before interest and taxes, EBIT. The earnings before interest and taxes. This is of some interest to us because it is at this point that we see whether we are on the good or the bad side of the pivot. Because at this point, I know how much money I have, so that when the interest on debt comes due, I know whether I am going to live to the next day or not. If my EBIT is $50,000 and my interest is $70,000, I'm dead. Game over. It's time to go on the TV talk show circuit and pretend I'm another Donald Trump who drives companies into the ground and then acts like an expert. Yes, you too can be an asshole. EBIT is the fulcrum. That's where we know whether we are going to live to the next day. And that's why we have that sort of way station there so that we know how we stand as we go to the interest line. We take out the interest and pray to God that we have a positive number here, EBT, earnings before taxes. And then we hack out the taxes. Now, taxes are sort of a pain in the butt. Usually in this class, now there will be one point where I have you actually do the real life calculation, but usually in this class, I'll just give you average tax rate, and then you just apply that to EBT to get your taxes, okay? I'll just say, well, taxes are 30% of EBT. In reality, it's a lot more complicated than that because we are in a progressive tax system so that at large, higher and higher blocks of income are taxed at higher and higher marginal tax rates. And it's actually the marginal tax rate that drives decision-making processes of both people and businesses. But we kind of suppress that in an early class like this. Later in a higher finance class, you would hear me talk more about marginal tax rates. I'll have you do a marginal tax rates calculation, but not here, not today. Once we have gotten the taxes paid, then we are at that happy line, net income. Here's the first round of it. Let me do this as a first round. Net income positive, good. Net income negative, bad. But you actually know it. It's a little more nuanced than that. Just because I have a net, now let me take you out of the accounting. Just because you have a net income that's a positive, a financial analyst would say, so what? Was that income positive enough to provide adequate reward for the risks taken in getting to that line? So just because you told me that you made $1 million in your business, that doesn't impress me at all until I know what you could have done otherwise with the capital that drove those expense lines. Okay? So tell me that net income is positive and watch me not jump for joy as a financial analyst. And that's one of the things that I will emphasize as we go through this course, so that when you go out there, you conduct business, but even if you are just an investor, don't just get all kinds of giddy and make monkey sounds if your companies that you invest in have positive net income. Always ask yourself, was this worth the risk? Tell you a quick story. There was this fellow I knew for years. He and I did a lot of business adventures together. And he decided he wanted to get into day trading. I guess you know what that is. You just sit at your computer all day playing with stocks. And that wasn't enough for him. He got a taste for futures contracts, which are the risk equivalent in finance of walking onto a battlefield wearing daisies and saying, shoot me, shoot me. Well, he put in close to $200,000 into futures contracts one morning. That would represent for him an exposure in the millions of dollars if things went south. He could literally take an ass bath by the end of the day just on little tiny blips in futures prices. We went to dinner. The son of a bitch wouldn't even sit still. He kept running to a payphone. It was before the days of cell phones. Calling his broker, where is it? Where is it? You know, the poor man almost died of a heart attack. By the end of the day, the man had actually made close to maybe it was like a grand or two. And the next, that later that night, I said, so are you going to do this again tomorrow? And he said, he called me all kinds of names, started with mother and things. No, I'm never going to do that again. He couldn't take the aggravation. As in his famous words, it wasn't worth the aggravation. The poor man made a couple of grand, but he also nearly killed himself with worry over what he had done. It wasn't worth it to him. Okay, so keep that in mind. Okay, now we've gotten this down to the net income line. Now, once a company has its net income, it's got two things that it can do with net income. One is that it can give it to the shareholders, or it can plow it right back into the company. The question that has persisted for decades among financial analysts, and I think I already brought this up a little bit, why would you give it to the shareholders? Don't you have something you can do with that net income? Can't you plow it back in? Are you saying that you could not use every dollar of that money that you made to make more money? And that question is persistent. And as I said, our best understanding is that the dividend that's paid represents a signal. It's not that you really should pay the shareholders. It's not that you couldn't use that money yourself in the corporation for new projects for next year. It's that we have to do something to show the shareholders that we can afford to provide a little bit for them. It would be nice, for example, if, well, it's very likely that that dividend is mostly a signal. If you keep it level and stable, that says something. If you can't pay it, that says something. If you up it a little bit, that says something. It's a signal. So we have the net income, and then we take out the dividends, and what remains is the addition to retained earnings. Now, understand there is no such thing as a cash, a checking account or a savings account of a corporation that says retained earnings. I've actually heard twice in meetings, I think, someone said, well, we'll just finance this project from retained earnings, which is, they might have just meant it sort of metaphorically, but if they meant it literally, I mean, they're dumbbells. There's no such thing as retained earnings. It's like sort of like a tracking system for how much accumulated money has flowed to the shareholders of the corporation. But it doesn't represent something that the shareholders can reach into, that the company can reach into and actually get cash money. It's entirely a representation of the life of the corporation at the end of each day. The income statement represents a flow of monies through a period. And then that retained earnings represents the reservoir, the addition to the reservoir at the end of the period of the accounting statement. So then we can talk about a statement of retained earnings. Which would be a second financial statement of the company. The statement of retained earnings simply says retained earnings at the beginning of the period and then plus the net income less the dividends. And then that represents the reservoir at the end of the period, the retained earnings reservoir
at the end of the period. So let me make a kind of a side point here. And I've been so excited sometimes saying, well, I see something that they really don't talk about so much in early accounting courses. And accounting people say, meh, big deal. But let me make the point here, because it is important to a financial person. You see, this net income, this income statement, all is coming down to this piece right here. So the statement of retained earnings actually embeds the income statement. The income statement is like a giant nodule sitting off the statement of retained earnings. It's like this quick sidebar calculation that gets us this number that goes into the statement of retained earnings. And then the statement of retained earnings becomes part of the next statement, which is the balance sheet of the corporation. And the balance sheet of the corporation is pretty straightforward, at least overall, for our purposes. We're not going to get really complicated with it. But the balance sheet, on one side are the assets, and on the other side are the liabilities, and then the owner's equity, which should add together to be exactly equal to the assets. And I'm sure you've seen this before. And this is one of those places where accounting becomes at least most people's greatest pain is making sure that your foots are all equal and that the sum of these two equals this one. And as I said when I used to teach accounting, if all else fails, multiply by the damn page number and see if that gets you what you need. Which is obviously why I don't teach accounting much anymore. Anyway, now for our purposes, the assets comprise short-term and long-term, liabilities, short-term and long-term. In the short-term assets are cash, accounts receivable, and prepaid expenses, and inventory, oops. And then the long-term comprise, for our purposes really, we just say your fixed assets, gross fixed assets, less accumulated depreciation, which takes them down to get your net fixed assets. We don't get terribly fancy at this point with financial statements in finance. We are very interested in the details of these animals right here, but more not so much in an accounting sense. Like, for example, you talk about fixed assets. We care very much about those. What you buy, why you buy it, how it's performing for you. Similarly, on the short-term side, we care very much about all of these, but not in an accounting sense. We care about them more in the sense of how they are benefiting the corporation. Are they earning enough? Are they balanced in such a way that they are earning us as much as they can? In the short-term liabilities, you have your accounts payable, and then maybe some notes. Down here, you have your bonds. We again, internally, we dig deep. But from a financial, from an accounting point of view, we just note it like this. That's how we do it. And then the owner's equity is essentially your common stock at par plus additional paid-in capital, how much you got for the stock above what its par value was, and then you got your statement of retained earnings plus retained earnings end of period, and that gives you your owner's equity. And like I said, this is a real summary. I'm sure you saw it in more depth and detail. But that's how we look at it. Now I'm going to make one more note here. One note. A couple of things. The biggie is your statement of cash flows, where we look at how the net income must be altered so that we understand what that means in terms of real cash money. So, for example, when you tell me net income, right off the bat, I'm going to add the depreciation back in from the income statement, right off the bat, because that wasn't a real expense. But I'm also going to have to make other modifications. Let's try this. Suppose that if I'm looking at my financial statements, I see that inventory from last year to this year went from $2,000 to $3,000. Does that represent cash coming into our company or cash going out of our company? Bingo. Because I spent money on inventory. I don't see that on the income statement because remember what I said specifically was cost of goods sold does not represent what you didn't sell. What you didn't sell is an inventory. Let's try another one. I paid off a bond. Talk to me. Is that a use of cash or a source of cash? Yeah. I sold some stock of the corporation in a public offering. Is that a source or a use? Good. Good. Actually, it's not really hard. My accounts payable went from $8,000 to $12,000. Talk to me. Is that a source or a use of cash?
That's a source.
Bingo, because I ain't paying my bills. And I admire that. In a company as well as in a person, unless the person owes me money. Yes, it's a source. It's almost like a common sense kind of thing. Sometimes you can get yourself spun around a little bit, but it's actually a common sense kind of thing. And we'll go through a detailed example of that on Tuesday. But that's your statement. That would be your statement of cash flows. Now, there's one more statement. And I'm just kind of curious to finish this off today. One more statement. And I am curious from your perspective, if this was emphasized enough to you that you remember it. Now, am I correct that most of you, if you were being tortured at Gitmo, you would remember these four statements, right? You would remember, as to some extent, well, the income statement, the balance sheet, statement of retained earnings, statement of cash flows. You'd remember those. I mean, under enough pressure or under hypnosis or the proper drug therapy, you'd remember those. There's another financial statement. Do any of you know what it is or remember it? Yeah, it's the notes to the financial statement. They are a weapon. The notes to the financial statement are point by point comments explaining why the numbers were put down the way they were. And the background behind the numbers, the way they were put down. When I wrote financial statements for companies, those notes were one of the ways that I signaled the investment community about what was going on behind the pure numbers, explaining, well, this is why we did it the way we did it to get this number. Or, well, that common stock you see sold, you saw that obviously common stock was sold. Well, did you know that we sold all of that to the president of the company at par? Well, let's tell you about that in the notes to the financial statement. Oh, our company is in serious trouble? Well, I've got a way that I can actually even say that on the financial statements without it even looking like I'm saying, you're a dumbass if you invest in us. Which I actually did on a couple of occasions. I was taught how to use the language by one of the compliance officers at the NASD. We would get companies listed with the NASD, which required that we have good financial statements audited and all that. And this woman, one of the old-time reviewers there, she said, look, the company sucks, doesn't it? Yeah, she was in New York. She said, good, here's what I want you to do. This is the language in the last footnote to the financial statements.
the ability of this company to satisfy its liabilities in a timely fashion with the revenues that are being realized is in doubt. That's a fancy way of saying you ain't going to get paid. This company's going to go into bankruptcy and you're going to lose your ass. Okay? It was a nice way to do it. Those notes of the financial statement, they have all kinds of teeth in them. You look at those and you'll see things that aren't there in just the plain dry numbers. It's a way to know more about a company. And I guarantee you, in a finance class, I will show you some notes of financial statements and we'll look at what they are saying to us, learning how to read the tea leaves, which is what we do in finance. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.